Taxation is theft.
Please, at least leave us alone in our living room.
My job is to find the truth.
Double the taxes.
I'm a human being. God damn it. My life has value.
Triple the taxes.
This is an IRS agent's dream.
If you think that the Capitol will ever treat us fairly, you are lying to yourself.
Beautiful, lovely taxes.
Sorry, but I don't do taxes.
Did you see the memo about this?
The government is a greedy piglet.
Just leave us alone.
Do you know what Ralph just said?
The roads.
You boys like Mexico?
I'm as bad as hell, and I'm not gonna take this anymore.
Welcome back, everybody. Taxation is theft. I guess Mark got a good kick out of that.
There was a theme emerging there, it seemed. And, you know, that you have that, and then the hat. So I'm wondering, Dan, what would be your one issue?
Let me think. Yeah. I think it would have to be taxes.
Yeah, I think so too. Yeah. I thought you were going to say sex work.
Yeah. No, okay. A couple things. First of all, everybody, welcome to Taxation is Theft. Tonight I have Mark Whitney. Yay. Cheers. Okay. So
yeah, that's right.
Welcome.
Try to control yourself, people.
During that intro, because I talked to my friend out in California today, and he was talking about how they're just like fucking everybody left and right. And as I'm watching this, like the guy from the, I think it was like a Disney cartoon, double the taxes, triple the I'm like, holy shit, that's California. Yeah. That's like the governor of California.
they made a new law out here that declared independent contractors employees. It's screwing everybody up. No one can do anything now.
So my friend was like, he's like, dude, I've been doing contract work this whole time, and now I'm fucked because the company I was working for won't hire me. And then he's like, and he's from Texas. He's like, I was going to get back into doing construction work, but apparently you need a permit to do construction work.
You need a permit to sell cars in California. To be a car salesman, everything is they've got it pretty well locked down out here, but they do have a nice ocean. There's a really nice ocean. They keep a nice ocean just to the left of where I'm standing right now. And then there's like sand and sun. And, you know, I moved here from New England. They throw in an extra 6 months at no extra. Well, I can't say at no extra charge. It's really expensive to live here, but I do feel if I'm being honest, it's not that I don't mind paying the taxes, but I do feel like I get a tremendous value living here compared to living in New England. In Vermont, the taxes were also usurious, but they had no ocean, and 6 months a year was not fit for human beings. So it all depends on where you're coming from.
Okay, look, I grew up in Los Angeles, so I know I'm familiar with the California coastline.
All right,
it's much cheaper.
Oh yeah, yeah.
The beaches are nicer.
I know. Are you in Mexico now?
Yeah, I'm down in Cancun right now.
The water is good for you.
Blue. Yeah, this is my campaign HQ.
That's cool, man.
Yeah,
it's so dark. So
seriously.
So I'll do that. The travel for me can be complicated. One of the reasons I want to be president is so I have diplomatic immunity and could go places. I just want to take my wife on an Alaskan cruise. I got to get elected president to do it, right? You know, because it leaves out of Vancouver.
Do you have to use a passport when you go to another country as president?
That's not, no. You don't have to do that.
Do you need the visa and the stamp and like, do you have to wait in the line?
Not a visa. You need a MasterCard though. Yeah. Or Amex or something. Yeah. But I was going up, I'll tell you a story about I have a border story. So 2007, I was scheduled to perform at a 2-week theater festival in Winnipeg, Canada. So I'm in San Diego, right? And I like to drive when I'm doing a tour. So the tour was starting in Winnipeg. So the way you get to Winnipeg from San Diego is you drive north and you take a right at Idaho and then a left at North Dakota, and then you hit Winnipeg. So as luck would have it, just as I was about to cross the border to Canada, some chucklehead set off a bomb in the Middle East. So naturally, they pulled everybody over at the border of North Dakota and Canada. Makes perfect sense.
Right, right. Because immediately after you set one off in the Middle East, you're going straight for Canada.
Absolutely. And so everybody, all of the U.S. citizens who are going into Canada, all the Canadians returning, the Canadian officials made everybody pull over and get out of their car and go inside. And so I'm waiting in line. I get up to the counter, and the lady has questions. And one of them is, have you ever been convicted of a crime in California? And I said, no. She says, fine. She takes my license. She goes away. She comes back. She had a very ugly stare on her face. And she said, I thought you said you'd never been convicted of a crime. And I said, well, not in California. You said California. Ask me another state. And when you get it right, I'll say yes. So she said, New Hampshire. I said, yeah, 1991, I had a little problem with a bank, but it all kind of worked out. So the funny thing is, they couldn't figure out what it was that they had a printout, but they didn't know what it was I'd been convicted of, whether I kidnapped children or robbed. So I actually went back into their back office with them and sat down on the computer and pulled up the U.S. code and showed them the little part where I had lied to the bank 30 years ago. And so here's what they did. I was going up to perform in a theater festival for 2 weeks, right? So they gave me a choice. I could write them a check for $200 and get a two-week work permit, or I could give them $1,200 and have a work permit for life. So it's not that they weren't going to let me go to Canada. They just wanted me to pay. And that's just one of the many insults that you have to suffer.
That's what I would expect from Mexico.
Yeah. So it was a shakedown. It was just a shakedown is what it was, you know, and now that I'm in the database, if I want to go to, so my wife and I used to have a second home up on the Canadian border of Vermont near Montreal. And if I want to go up there, we want to go up there just for lunch in old Montreal. I can't get into Canada for pleasure. I can only get in for work now that I'm in the database. So I'm kind of like Martha Stewart. Like Martha Stewart can't travel internationally because she's convicted of a crime, but she's famous. So she goes, she once, shortly after she got out of prison, she went over to London and they sent her back. They wouldn't let her in. She knew she'd been convicted of a felony. And so there are 25 million people like me that have that disability, and international travel I'm okay going to London. In fact, I've been to London since then, but I can't go to Canada and get a pizza. I can't. That's, but if I want to work there and I buy a permit, they'll let me in.
So this is, I always have this question, because like I've been to so many countries and like they have, so I've been to Uganda and like they have a computer and they scan my passport and I'm like, are these guys really like connecting to the U.S. database and like?
No, they're connecting. They're checking to see if you're in Interpol. So Kathy Griffin, remember when Kathy Griffin held up the effigy of Trump's head, and everyone got all upset. So the Trump crime family responded. The attorney general put her in Interpol for doing that. So when she went out traveling to do her stand-up comedy internationally, she would get detained sometimes for up to 24 hours in a holding cell at that country's point of entry. Oh, wow. Because she came up in Interpol, which is not a database you want to come up in. That's the kind of database when you come up, the eyes of the person open wide and they go, oh, like that. You know, people who sit in these cages and do this all day long, go, okay, fine. You're fine.
Finally, something to do.
It's fine. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So that was her life for about 18 months. She hired a great First Amendment lawyer, made a documentary out of it. She couldn't get, after she did that, she couldn't get booked in the United States. So she toured in Europe and she sold out shows over there. But people of the United States, the authoritarians here, were having none of that. Holding up a pretend picture of a president's head, it's just too much for them.
Right, you know? From Hollywood, who absolutely hates Trump.
Yeah, well, I mean, I defend Kathy Griffin, I defend Kathy Jones, or Alex Jones. Neither one of them did anything that even approached running afoul of the First Amendment. It was all peaceful. Nobody's climbing the White House fence with a machine gun on their shoulder or anything. You know, they're just artists out there doing their thing.
Alex Jones did call a bunch of frogs gay, which is kind of a hate crime.
Yeah, it is. A lot of people do. They think there's a whole contingent of Frog alumni from Harvard that are very offended by that sort of shit. You know, that's an interesting thing, the hate speech and how they're using that to censor people whose political opinions they don't agree with, right? Because
you and I both know that
a government that has the power to define hate has the power to define love. And who wants to live in that country?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I get shit for, like, defending free speech when it's, like, you know, Nazis talking shit. And, like, I just like to say, okay, well, they're assholes. Would you rather them keep it to themselves, or would you like to know who the assholes are?
Yeah, I'm always interested. I always want to know why people think what they think. You know, I always want to know their story. I don't really care that they think something. I'm like, why do you think that? How did you get to this point? You know?
So it's funny that, I don't know, I guess some people think you're enabling them or something, but I don't know.
I don't think so.
Yeah. So interesting story. So I met you for the first time in New Hampshire.
Right.
For everybody who doesn't know, Mark Whitney had a delusion of grandeur that he could enter into this race and beat me. I met him at the New Hampshire debate, Libertarian presidential debate, and we actually had an interesting conversation because you've got a history with one of my personal heroes, Erwin Schiff.
Right.
Is that right?
I do. Yeah. It goes way back. You want to hear the story?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a really interesting story. I don't think I've had a chance to get into it on a debate, but the first time I heard the word, just talk to me. I feel like the, are you
check,
still
check,
there?
Check.
Yeah. Okay, good. The first time I heard the word libertarian, I was 22 years old and I'm working at a TV station in Boston, and TV's on the third floor, the fifth floor. There's a talk station, and there was 9 hours a day of libertarian programming on this talk station in Boston in 1982. There were three talk show hosts, and the guy that did the 10 o'clock to 1 o'clock shift, guy named Gene Burns, he's fantastic. We became friends. He was openly libertarian. And openly libertarian. That's right. He was out.
Right.
And he used the word, and he actually ran for president on the libertarian banner in 1984. So he did a 3-hour show every day. And he opened the show with the same question every day for 3 hours. What is the nature and role of government in a free society? And he unpacked that question every day. And he ended the show every day with the First Amendment. The Gene Burden program is brought to you by a grant from the First Amendment to the United States Constitution. And when I heard Gene Burns using the word libertarian and talk about it, it sounded to me like ninth grade civics, which was the only academic subject that I loved in high school. The rest of it you could have. I like theater, music, woodshop, and civics. That was it. And anything that had anything to do with skiing was also good. Because Vermont is where they keep the snow back then.
Did
anyway.
Was that your PE class, skiing? Did they have that?
Skiing was just what you did. I lived, my dad owned, my family never bought a house, but my dad rented an old farmhouse in Vermont on 125 acres of land. And so when my mother said, go out and play, we had a lot of land to play on. And it was a little town of 200 people. And there was a really rich dude, like 2 miles up the road, who owned something called Marineland in Florida, which became SeaWorld. And he owned 5,000 acres, this guy. And he had a ski area that he built, a small ski area that he had to entertain his friends from New York when they came to visit. And he wanted to cover the cost, so he opened it to the public. So whenever there was snow and no school, I walked 2 miles to that ski area, and I always skied. So in high school, we did slalom, we did giant slalom downhill, we did cross country skiing, and then we also did Nordic jumping. Middlebury Snowball had a 55-meter ski jump that we used in high school. That's no longer allowed for insurance purposes. It's just one more government intrusion. Gene Burns, one of his favorite guests was this guy, Erwin Schiff, that you mentioned. Now, people need to be of a certain age to know of Erwin Schiff, maybe, or perhaps they're involved in the get rid of the 16th Amendment or the tax resistance movement. But Erwin was the most popular radio talk show host guest in the country in the 80s. And I'll just say the 80s and the first couple of years of the 90s. He wrote the IRS, as you know, wrote a book that says you need to pay your taxes. And Irwin wrote, I think, 8 books that say, no, you don't. And so I did not meet Irwin Schiff in the 80s, but I would listen to him on the Gene Burns program and other programs in Boston talking about how you don't have to pay your taxes. And I was a young entrepreneur. I was 22. I was working at this TV station in Boston, but we lived in New Hampshire. So 4 days a week, I commuted to Boston. And then 2 days a week, I commuted to Vermont, up near Dartmouth in Vermont, New Hampshire, area, where my advertising agency was, which I started when I was like 20, 21. And so I was doing 2 things at once. And this idea of not paying your taxes sounded great to me. And Irwin convinced me I didn't have to do that. So for 3 years in my early 20s, I didn't file my taxes with IRS, thanks to Irwin's advice. But then when I got to be like 25 and my wife became pregnant with our first son, I said to myself, I gotta address this tax situation. I wasn't sure how I was going to do it. Around that same time, Ben and Jerry went public, and Vermonters were given a year to buy the stock over everybody else. And then they also started franchising. And I thought that was a great idea because the only thing we had in Vermont was maple syrup and ice cream. And so I said, I'm going to hitch my wagon to that. So I didn't do any research. I took the money I had and went out and borrowed against the house. We had about $250,000 worth of equity in this house that we owned. And and I got my first franchise. And I built them like really fast. Delicatessens and ice cream shops all over New Hampshire. And when I would go down to the bank and say, I need to borrow $1 million, they would say, we can give you $15 million. And I didn't fill out any applications or anything. All of these little banks were for sale in 1988. And what they did is they were blowing money out the door to idiots like me, because when a bank loans you money, that goes in the bank's asset column. And it goes in my liability column. I didn't realize that at the time. I didn't know anything about money. I wasn't even paying my taxes. And so when they asked for tax returns, I gave them 2 tax returns that accurately reflected my income, but they were not filed with the IRS. That was the wrinkle. So when one of the banks I was doing business with got in trouble with the feds for making loans that were illegal loans, this one bank I did business with, I called them the Cowboy National Bank. Their slogan was the bank that serves you. And I would say to my wife, yeah, papers. And so they made a loan to me that exceeded their legal lending limit. This little bank was only allowed to loan $1 million and loan me 2. So when they got in trouble with the feds for making loans that were too big, which is they're trying to ratchet up their asset sheet to dump the bank off to the Bank of Boston. When the feds came in and investigated the bank, well, guess who had the biggest loan in the history of the bank? That was me. And so then they start looking into me and they find this little tax return problem. And, you know, when the bank got in trouble, you know, my payments were current. I never missed out on any payments, but we end up filing a Chapter 11 trying to reorganize. And all the banks that did business with, they said I'd lied to them. And the judge laughed them out of the court. He said, these tax returns don't show any evidence of an ability to repay these loans at all. You people are idiots for loaning this idiot all that money. You all deserve what you got. Get out of my courtroom. I got a complete discharge. So that really pissed them off. So then they go down to the U.S. Attorney's Office, and it turns out in the criminal arena, it's like what Ed Snowden is charged with. It's a strict liability crime. So all the government has to show is that the IRS you gave the bank doesn't match the tax return you gave the bank doesn't match the tax return you gave IRS, even though the tax returns have been amended. Right. They had been amended and I had incurred an enormous debt to IRS of almost $1 million. None of that mattered. So it's a strict liability crime. I was not allowed to turn to the jury and say, this is why I did what I'd done. You know, I was trying to get things right. Da, da, blah, blah, blah. Not a defense. Same thing with Ed Snowden. He's charged with espionage. So all the government has to prove in that case is that he took some shit he's not meant to take. That's it. He doesn't get to turn to the jury and say, yes, but I took an oath to preserve and protect the Fourth Amendment, and my boss, James Clapper, lied when he said they weren't collecting. They're violating the Fourth Amendment, so I, Ed Snowden, upheld my oath. He can't say that. It's not a defense. And espionage, he can get up to life in prison, so that's why he hasn't come home. And he said that if they would let him turn to the jury and say that, he would come home and stand trial, but that's what the law is.
Yeah.
So So here's the funny part, right? So I get indicted by the feds on these tax return things. I defend myself in federal court, facing 225 years in federal prison. It becomes an award-winning show. This is not the path I would recommend to people to having an award-winning show, but it's the path I took. It was a difficult path for many years. There was a lot of litigation. I had a lot of success in the courts defending myself, and turned out I'm pretty good at it. But here's the punchline, Dan. 1982, first time I heard the word libertarian, or right around that same time, 1983, 84, first time I heard the name Erwin Schiff. And the government put me on the diesel tour for about a month. And that's when, instead of letting you self-surrender through the prison camp, they drive you around, dump you in a lot of different prisons. And I was in maximum security for a while. I was in a prison that looked just like the prison on the Shawshank Redemption. And, I'm selling ice cream. They got doors the size of Cinderella's castle that say Jail 1 on them. And they got tiers and the cells, all that stuff. I finally end up at Allenwood Federal Prison Camp, 9 hours away from my house in White Deer, Pennsylvania, which is every bit the metropolis it sounds like. And hand to God, my first day there at lunch, who lumbers up and introduces himself as the nation's leading authority on the income tax? Fucking Erwin Schiff.
Nice.
And I said, I know you. I listened to you on the radio, and I didn't pay my taxes because I listened to you. And so he keeps going on about what an expert he is. And I said, you realize where we're having this conversation? And it was his second conviction. And so long story short, we became great friends. We lived together for a while. I helped him edit the revision of his book, The Federal Mafia. Nice. A lot of times my editing would be things like, are you sure you've thought this through? Because here's the deal with Erwin. The reason I have empathy for Erwin is because he did not have a criminal bone in his body. Erwin sold books for $20. He believed what he believed, right? And I look at the Constitution, I see the 16th Amendment, and I'm like, the income tax is theft made legal. I would just add the word legal to your taxation is theft hat. We also make killing legal when we create a military. We the people are imperfect. And I wouldn't recommend to anybody to not pay their income tax. Well, and really not paying is not the crime. The crime is not accounting to the government. If you don't account to the government, it really doesn't matter whether you can pay. But if you don't file that accounting and they find out that you didn't do that, that's criminal. And you can end up, having lunch with Erwin Schiff for doing that. Right. But Erwin was a great guy. We worked in the law library for months together. He and I were always in the law library. I worked in the laundry. He worked in the kitchen. We would help each other, and I've seen him naked in the shower several times. nothing special going on there. But then I got out when I won my appeal and got my order for immediate release. The government sued me to make sure I didn't help prisoners on cases, because not only was I successful in my own case, I was successful in many other cases. And what I was going to do was do contract legal research under the supervision of some pretty high profile criminal defense lawyers.
Oop. I just lost you. I don't know if you can still hear me. There you go. All right, you're back.
Yeah, so here I am, a high school graduate from a little school in Vermont. And it turns out I'm like one of the best federal post-conviction experts in the country. I was like, and I'm working with clients that F. Lee Bailey is. So there was this banker F. Lee Bailey had for a client who hired me to keep an eye on F. Lee Bailey, because F. Lee Bailey was representing OJ. And I found out that F. Lee Bailey had made a mistake. And F. Lee Bailey's malpractice company ended up writing my guy a check for $500,000 based on a mistake that I found out. And so I have all kinds of stories about that from my days immediately following my getting my prison term declared unconstitutional. But Irwin took a different path. Irwin went from the federal prison in Pennsylvania to Nevada, Nevada. You lose votes if you don't know how to pronounce the state.
Oh, shit.
And I learned how to, I was in Reno this weekend and they taught me and I've forgotten since. I think it's Nevada. Nevada is how we say it in New England. It's Nevada. So anyway, Irwin moved to Las Vegas and he opened a store called paynoincometax.com. Mm-hmm. And he had a website and a store there. And he got hammered, as I'm sure you know, on his third conviction. But here's what I say is Irwin's biggest legacy. It has nothing to do with taxes. Irwin Schiff is the only citizen from like 1900 to this moment who had a book censored by order of a federal judge. He's the only one. It only happened once.
They
got him. The judge ordered him that he couldn't sell the book. Oh, they did get it. He was enjoined from selling that book. Yeah. Yeah. So I have a copy of the Federal Mafia. Not that I'm going to follow any of the advice in it, but I have a copy of it because it's enshrined on my shelf as the one book that's been censored by a federal judge in like the last 125 years. The last one was from some woman. They thought she was a witch or something. I can't remember what the hell it was. But I mean, that is quite an achievement. When you think about the universe of abhorrent thoughts that people put pen to paper, right? And the one book that gets is a book that says, you might not want to pay your taxes. So cheers, Irwin Schiff. Irwin died chained to a hospital bed. He was memorialized in the New York Times. There was a reporter at the New York Times who followed every move of Irwin Schiff, that reporter. If you go through the New York Times archives, you'll find a couple of dozen articles on Irwin Schiff. And it was the same reporter that wrote about him all the time. And you could tell the reporter was a fan because you could not like Irwin. He was such a rogue and he had such a big heart and he was hilarious. Have you ever seen the YouTube of Irwin at the 1996 convention?
No, I didn't see that one.
Oh,
I've seen a lot of his videos, though.
He was a presidential candidate that year, and he killed. He got all the laughs. He didn't get any votes, but he got all the laughs. One of the questions was, as we always get, right, if you're not the nominee, will you support whoever is the nominee? And Irwin got up and he said, well, I'll support him. I can't vote for him, but I'll support him. Because of his civil disability, of his conviction, he was not allowed to vote in Connecticut. So when I beat you and become the president, I will advocate that people who share my civil disability are allowed to vote. Because, you know, the funny thing is, prisoners retain the right to access the courts under the First Amendment. They retain speech rights. They retain all their peaceful constitutional rights. And, 90% of the people who go to prison, they're coming back out. So one of the nice things you can do that doesn't cost anybody any money is you can let these people who go to prison also retain the title of citizen, which is the highest office in the land. So how did it become normalized that people who are incarcerated don't vote? I'll tell you how. They know too much. They know too much. These are the people who live the entire Bill of Rights, and they know the system in and out. And they're all libertarians. Every one of them. Like, you go into prison a Republican, you come out a libertarian. You go into a Democrat, you come out a libertarian. Go in independent, you come out a libertarian. Go in green, you come out a libertarian. That's the experience of going from living a First Amendment life to living the entire Bill of Rights. Right. You know, nobody wants to wake up and be living the Sixth Amendment, which affords you the right to counsel. Nobody wants that. Nobody wants to ever have to live the Sixth Amendment. That's a bad day.
Yeah.
You know?
And what's interesting is, like, I always bring up this point, like, to the people who think felons shouldn't be allowed to vote, what are you afraid of? They're gonna vote to legalize murder? Like, it's absolutely ridiculous if you think about it. Like,
yeah, I mean, murder, legalizing murder isn't on the ballot, right? I mean, it's just which candidate do you support?
It's which murderer do you want to pick? And apparently all the non-felons are doing a really bad job at figuring that out.
Yeah. You know, when I ran for office in 1996, in Vermont, I participated in about 20 candidate forums, and I always used to joke that, you know, I don't think voters are going to mind that, you know, I got convicted of a crime before taking office. You know, that was, you know, we elect people and then they commit crimes. I got it all out of my system. That was my nice. Argument. And I got it out of my system at a young age, 30 years ago, you know, and one way or another, there were things that I had to learn in order to be a good dad. And those things are going to have to be learned at some point, because I grew up in a family that just told me I could be and do whatever I want, which is fine. But there was no the flip side of that. Like we libertarians were all about, you know, it's kind of that we're kind of the party of try and try again, keep trying, keep banging until you get it right. And if you need some help or advice, we'd be happy to give that to you. But don't ask us to pay for your mistakes. Just go out and try again. That's kind of what we're about. We're kind of the party of entrepreneurship and just, you know, keep banging, as I like to say. But the flip side of that is that I think as you make mistakes and as you get older, you become more accountable to yourself. You become your sense of individual responsibility increases proportionally with your time on this earth and the experiences you have. And I think really the whole purpose of your 20s is to just go out there and step on your dick. I mean, that's kind of what your 20s are for, you know?
Right. Yeah, So I'm faced with this a lot, right? I call myself a high school dropout, even though I technically graduated, but I don't know how, because I slept through all those classes. Went to community college for a little bit. Now I'm a software engineer, but I spent most of my 20s just dicking around doing, you know, whatever stupid jobs I could get. I did a tour around the country where it was like we jokingly called it Girls Gone Mild, because it was like these, you know, B-list celebrities, we're following them around with cameras and watching them get drunk, and that's a reality show, and it was like direct to TV, and no one was getting paid. It was a total shit show, but everyone didn't care, because we were, you know, we were out there getting drunk and just partying as part of this thing. And that was right. My 20s. And it's like, so people come to me now and they're like, oh, well, my kid's having trouble in school and his grades aren't that great. And I'm just kind of like, I want to tell him, like, so like, what do you want to do? Force him to get good grades, force him to go to college that he's going to hate. He obviously has right. his own passions. Let him do those. But like at the yeah. same time, I'm like, I'm kind of being a bad influence. Like, what do I tell him? Yeah, let him go out and get shit faced for his 20s.
No, but I think that actually is, I think that, so I'm like this huge fan of making mistakes. I think that I don't even consider them mistakes. Like when I open my comedy club and new comics would come in, I say to them, look, you succeed when you take that stage, because 999 of 1,000 people are never going to go up there. So it doesn't matter what happens when you go up there, just get up there and start sucking. Okay. And in about 7 years, you might be a comedian. So get going, because you're going to suck for a while. So let the public humiliation begin. And then eventually you get better. You know, stand-up comedy starts below the belt, works its way up to the heart, eventually up to the head, and then you got something. But, yeah, I think that, you know, you decide, like running for president, right? You decide you're going to run for president, right? You tell people that, they just start laughing, right? And So you have something that gets you off the couch. For you, it was taxes. The thing that really tipped it for me was the algorithms that are censoring people for hate speech, and people are getting censored by the thousands now for political speech, whereas back under the old operating system of book and paper, it only happened once to people like Erwin Schiff. So I said to myself, well, this is a structural problem. I'm an algorithm salesman. Maybe I can help start a conversation about this before they write independent journalists out of the Constitution. And so that was the thing that kind of got me off the couch. I had to, when the tech companies got together and censored Alex Jones off their platforms all on the same day, I had to go walk on the beach for about 2 weeks. It really altered my universe, because while it's true that the courts have sucked when it comes to ballot access, the federal courts in the United States have been fantastic when it comes to keeping their grubby paws off political speech. The First Amendment, that injunction in the First Amendment that we the people put there has worked really well. But now we have this new operating system that is dominated by, you know, these platforms in the private sector, the Communications Act, Section 230, it prevents us from suing Twitter and Facebook and Jack Dorsey and all that because they have an exemption from being sued because they're just a platform. But there's also censorship going on with what the platform covers. Section 230 Communications Act says we can't sue them, and then we sign a terms of service agreement that conflicts with the terms of citizenship. The terms of service says Jack Dorsey can take you off of Twitter for any reason or no reason at all. And if you want to sue them, you can't. You have to go to private arbitration, which is binding. And then the Supreme Court recently ruled if you sign an arbitration agreement, you can't participate in a class action. So if you are somebody like you or me or any of our opponents in this race, and you're expressing political opinions that don't show up on the Wall Street traded media outlets, you're more likely to be censored on these platforms than they are. And recently, we were treated to Kamala Harris, the former highest ranking law enforcement officer in California, berating Elizabeth Warren in a debate because Elizabeth Warren would not pledge to censor Donald Trump off the internet. You know, the president of the United States, she's saying, should be deleted from Twitter. That's Kamala Harris. And so, you know, I did a podcast one day where I said, you know, nothing brings people together who never say private companies can do whatever they want, like censorship they agree with. Censorship they agree with, they're like, yeah, private companies can do whatever they want. Well, you know, my progressive friends in Vermont, they never say that. My friends in Vermont who vote for Bernie, they never say private companies can do whatever they want. Unless they're censoring political opponents, then it's like terrific. And so I don't have the answers to this. My feeling is that these are new questions. And if anybody is going to dig into these questions and juggle them, it's going to be libertarians. It's not going to be Republicans or Democrats, because they are the people who benefit from the censorship of political speech. And Dianne Feinstein has testified before Congress. I've got the clip. She has said that we have to create a class of journalists that have certain bona fides, that journalism is a right, not a privilege. And so they could actually, next year, we could be treated to a show that says, we're going to break up these companies. And on page 44,000 and footnote 3 of the bill, they could just write independent journalists right off the internet. And it'd be unconstitutional, but it'd take us 20 years to unring that bell. You know how they are.
Right. Yeah. And that's I think it was Elizabeth Warren talking about, she wants to break up some of these big companies and, you know,
right.
And it's like, okay, so they want to split them in half so that there's more competition, but really they're already split. There's already that competition. It's already Facebook versus Twitter versus YouTube. They're all different platforms. And there's a million other platforms out there too, that are like MeWe and like all the smaller platforms that
right.
They just don't have the traffic. So it's like, I still see this as, you know, let them do whatever they want. You did sign that contract, so honor that contract. And you did say, I want this stupid Twitter app, so that's your problem
right.
to deal with it. And if it's going
right.
to brainwash yourself, well, that's what you signed up for. But there's nothing preventing anybody else, I mean, unless there is, and that I have a problem with, there's nothing preventing
right.
anyone else from saying, I'm going to make Twitter 2 or, you know, whatever, copy of Twitter. What do they call it in Silicon Valley?
Yeah, that's true. So I understand what you're saying. So here's my, and I'm not even making an argument, because these are just things that I'm playing around with in my mind. But, if Amazon and Google and YouTube and Twitter and Facebook combined have the power to suck all the intellectual property out of the market, all the people like yourself who are programmers, and pay them more than they're worth, and get them to sign non-disclosure agreements. They're using their market power to do that. And if they do have monopolies, libertarians oppose monopolies. So if it does become a monopolistic situation, Amazon is famous for strip mining software that small developers create, and just annihilating small people. They're very aggressive. And I'm a free market guy. I mean, I've been an entrepreneur for 40 years. But when it, and I agree with what you say with regard to competition and opening companies. I opened a company competing with two big companies. So I'm all about that. I get that. Like, if you don't like it, compete. That's like rule one for me. And then on the other side of that, political speech is sacrosanct. So if we have this principle that we as citizens are allowed to engage in unfettered political speech as a means of holding our government accountable, and the system for doing so is limited to three or four systems, in the same way that if I want to drive to the beach, you know, there's a road that will take me there. I can't go through the fields. I have to use that system, and I have to be on the right-hand side of the road, and it's a platform that I have to use. I really don't have a choice. My wife won't let me buy a helicopter, so especially after the Kobe Bryant thing. And I say that because we have a helipad right across from the house. Right across from our house, there's a helipad, and we have common area access to that helipad, just like the Qualcomm and the big companies around us. It's just it's something we share, and I'm like, there's a goddamn helipad right there. Certainly we could work out something to avoid this Interstate 5 when we have to go to L.A.
Back to your analogy, like if – because I don't see – okay, so like censorship in Twitter, I don't see so much as blocking somebody so much as saying, I have a tool and I don't want to give it to you. So like an analogy would be, let's say if there's like a political free speech rally – and on one side of the street, you've got 100 libertarians. And on the other side of the street, you've got 100 Democrats. And you've got Twitter, who basically says, we're going to buy 100 megaphones. And they go out there and they give one megaphone to each Democrat and nothing to the libertarians. Would it be fair to say, hey, Twitter, since you're giving megaphones to all the Democrats, you have to give them to the libertarians?
Correct. That's the principle. The principle is if on your platform you're going to carry political speech, you carry political speech. You don't have a test or you don't carry political speech. Political speech would be unique in that area just to be consistent with the spirit of the First Amendment, which is something ultimately the people have to hold in their heart. You know, the words on a cold piece of paper mean nothing if people don't believe in the principle. So if you subscribe to the principle of unfettered political speech as a means of holding the government accountable to the authority vested in citizens, if you believe in that principle, then the question arises, do you care who's violating that principle, whether it's a private sector system or a public sector system? If we are in a world where MSNBC, CNN, and Fox have unfettered access to put political opinion out there on these platforms, and then the Libertarian Party is reduced to posting 8.5 by 11 flyers on the community bulletin board, well, then the Libertarian Party is a debate society at that point. It's not a political organization anymore.
Right. Well, and so this is, I guess, devil's advocate for my own position.
Right.
Not necessarily what I believe in, but an interesting position that somebody could bring.
Yeah, because I don't have hard and fast feelings on this. I'm thinking about.
If someone were to say, okay, so we have the United States government. It is comprised of political parties and politicians with policies. And if somebody wants to report on that, or somebody wants to allow reporting on that, then okay, fine. But if somebody were to intentionally, maliciously allow misrepresentation of what that is, if someone were to intentionally print lies about something that the United States government is doing or any corporation, they could be sued as, you know, it's fraud.
That's true.
If you were to apply that same circumstance somehow to Twitter by saying you're attempting to represent the United States political system by saying it's a two-party system when really it's not, then you are defrauding the public in your representation of this, not private entity, but this public entity of the government.
Right. So if you remove Section 230 of the Communications Act, people can then sue Twitter. If they feel offended as citizens, you could bring a suit. There are things you could do, but there's federal law that exempts them because, you know, these companies have disproportionate political and economic influence. So they're able to, and this law is actually pretty old. So I don't know if you're aware, I've worked at three TV stations and two radio stations in my day. And the way the federal regulations work with regard to political advertising on TV and radio is that if you're running for office and you show up at the TV station with a 30-second commercial, under federal regulations, they have to, you want to advertise in 11 o'clock news, they have to drop the local car dealers and prioritize your political ad and put it on, and they have to give you the lowest published rate that they have at the station. That's a rule that the Democrats and Republicans got passed for themselves, so that whenever they want to run ads, it supersedes all of the businesses, and they get the benefit of the lowest rates. And there's another rule in the Code of Federal Regulations that says the TV and radio stations are forbidden from censoring those advertisements. So no matter what kind of shit you want to dump on your opponent in a political contest, you are free to do that, and the TV and radio stations are not permitted to apply any test or consider it for decency or anything.
Certainly, you know? They're still allowed to impose rules on profanity and nudity and...
Yeah, there are some other regulations about there's some other regulations about that, but just in terms of...
Because I'm just thinking about just, my ad.
Yeah, no, just in terms of, you know, telling a bald-faced lie about your opponent or something like that, that's fine, you know. Yeah, we saw him last night out in the alley behind the theater with some chick, you know. He claims to be all about taking care of women. Well, he was taking care of a woman out there, you know. Yeah. You can, you know, you
I mean,
can run that.
If it was a Democrat or Republican, it's probably true.
Yeah, because God knows all libertarians are totally normal, virginal human beings.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I used to own a comedy club. And,
yeah, but you could never insult us with that.
No, that was actually a pretty good training for running for president as a libertarian, as it turns out. And I think it's good training for running for president as a Democrat or Republican as well, because it's all kind of funny at the end of the day, you know, the way it all works. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think I'm having a good time with it. It's all joyful.
Yeah, it is. You know, one of the most rewarding things I think about this whole thing is when somebody comes to me and says, you know, how the things that I've said have like opened their eyes and changed their opinion of, or their view of what the system is and what needs to happen. And like everyone from Democrats to Republicans, it's amazing because it's like, you know, as libertarians, nobody gives a fuck about us. But then when people say, like, you actually made a difference in their life, then it's like, okay, wow. Okay, I guess this is all worth it.
Yeah. Yeah. I think we make it hard on ourselves when sometimes the way we talk, sometimes the way libertarians talk, it's as if we invented a second steering wheel. And you know, the Libertarian Party platform to me is just the Constitution, Bill of Rights in different words. It was the principles and the platform were extracted from these founding documents. And it's just a different way of saying the same thing. And this is just fundamental stuff. And one of the experiences I've had as someone who has toured a political dramedy, an autobiographical memoir steeped in libertarianism, is that, you know, the show Fool for a Client that I have at markwhitney.com, which you can watch for free if you go there and click memoir. That show is performed at the iconic Studio Theater. I did a 2-week run there. It's just down the road from the White House. And because I sell software to lawyers, I have all the email addresses on the lawyers. So when I go out to a city, I email the lawyers in that city. I say, there's going to be a show in town. You're a lawyer. The show is called Fool for a Client. So guess who comes to the show? So when I perform in D.C., half of the audience are prosecutors at the Department of Justice, and they got their wives or their husbands with them. And by the end of the show, they're giving a standing ovation to the libertarian, and they're handing me their business cards from down at the Department of Justice saying, I agree with everything you said. It's all fucked up. And my point being that one of the things I've learned when I perform this show, when you get people outside their news bubble, outside their off their treadmill, and they're just relaxed, Saturday night, it's 8 o'clock, they're ready to laugh. My show, Fool for a Client, reminds people what they forgot they believe. That's what it does. It reminds them what they forgot they believe, that they really do believe in unfettered free speech. They believe in privacy. They do believe in due process. They want people to get a fair shake when they have to be in court. They believe in equal justice and access to justice and equal protection of the law. They believe in these things. They just forgot that they believe it because the major messaging outlets ignore it. You know, when they just call it, you know how every news outlet and every cable channel, every newspaper online, they have a menu. They have a main navigation menu, right? And they have sports and they have fashion. And then one of the choices in the main navigation menu is politics. So if they were to just simply change the word politics to self-government, that would be a complete reframe of everything we're reading that's called politics. And if you were writing to a thesis of self-government as opposed to politics, which is just the horse race, politics is just who's up and who's down. But self-government is the principle that's at stake.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And that is a huge part of the whole thing, because when we talk about, you know, everything from socialism or statism and nationalism and all these things that are, you know, a lot of people are cheering for now. Yeah. A lot of that comes from two different things, but one is mostly people not living their own lives, expecting government to come in and solve their problems for them, expecting government to create their lives, to set out, you know, I mean, this whole concept that everybody lives by.
It never works.
Go to college, get married, have kids, retire.
It's terrible.
That's a government program. Terrible. That was created by somebody else. That's not you living your life. That's you trying to be a
cookie
cutter.
It's not you. Right. And education should be the most liberally construed word in the English language. I mean, what Bernie Sanders wants to do, you know, in with free college, what happens, you know, when you pass a law and you define something statutorily, you limit it. It then becomes an official definition. This is college. This is education. This is healthcare. And that the fact when you define something officially, it has a tremendous psychological effect on people. It has an effect on entrepreneurs who might be of a mind to compete with it. You know, I feel like, you know, in a free market, I feel like you would be able to just get in the car, you know, your kid breaks their leg and you'd be able to get in the car and you'd be able to go and they would fix the broken leg for what, $400 or $500. And then there would be that one time out of 10 where the leg was really broken and you got to go see somebody else and they're going to get paid more because it's more complicated. But, you know, the healthcare industry, they know, you know, just like we libertarian presidential candidates, we know what the top five FAQs are, right? We know what the right answers are to the top 10 libertarian FAQs. We know the doctrine, the theory, the philosophy, and we can recite it in our sleep. Same thing with the hospitals. They know what the most common things are, and these most common things in a free market would be very inexpensive, and then you would have an expensive place over there for the things that were uncommon. But instead, everything gets run through this funnel. My wife's got a thing going on with her sciatica, and we've got good insurance, and she's like been in pain for a month. You know, we're comfortable. Yeah. We've got some money. We got great insurance. Man. She's got great doctors when she can get there. But she has been literally she has days where she has to like lay on the floor and all this stuff, and she just wants to get. You know, she's gone to the anchor. She's trying everything to get rid of it, and eventually they will. But man, she's suffering for weeks now with this. You know,
yeah,
it's crazy.
There was this because of the opioid epidemic. Since you mentioned pain, there was this thing that I heard about with so the DEA basically can go to doctors and say you're overprescribing medication. There's no like legal limit. It's not 10 pills or 100 pills or anything like that. It's just overprescribing. So anybody can be charged with overprescribing. So instead what the doctors do is they vastly underprescribe and people are in pain. So they end up going to like, okay, what can I get? They either go to the black market and get the bad shit and kill themselves, or they go buy over the counter painkillers like Tylenol and whatever they can get without a prescription, and they overdose. Yeah. They get ulcers and they die. 30,000 people a year. Because their doctors can't give them the medication they need, they're going to die because the DEA, because they're worried about the DEA charging them for some other bullshit. I know I lost you again. You probably didn't hear me. There you go. I saw the, so you're, I know what camera you have now. Well, almost.
Yeah, no, I get it. I get what you're saying about the DEA and the rest of the alphabet. You know, the way you fill prisons is very simple, right? You just sit down and you make a list of all the shit people are going to do anyway, right? And then you make those things illegal. And they're going to do that shit anyway. And that's how you fill prisons. It's super simple. They've got it down to a science. I see many libertarians go, oh, this war on drugs is insane. No, it's not insane. It's a very well-oiled machine. And the privately, the publicly traded private prisons, they've got this shit all, they got actuaries. They got this shit all bulleted out and it's all systemized.
I learned this recently, like if you go all the way back to like, I think it was like early 1700s in the U.S., you had farmers coming here and they had all this land, but they didn't have anybody to farm it. So they needed people, right? And it was either, I think this was pre-slavery, but what they did was they went to, I want to say, they got some people from Europe to come down here. And the deal was, they gave them some kind of deal, like if you work on these farms, you'll earn, you know, some amount of money. And after a certain amount of time, you'll own your own piece of land. But they arranged it in such a way that it was like one of those loans that like you're earning so much interest that as you pay it off, it just gets bigger. And so, so they created a system that like sounded like a good deal and people voluntarily got involved and then they ended up as slaves. And this is exactly with, this is exactly what the government does with like they've got us on wage slavery because of the property taxes, which sounded like a good idea because we're going to get schools. The prison system, we got to get all the stoners off the road because they're going to kill somebody. It sounded like a great idea. Next thing you know, your kids are in prison working as slave labor. And it's like these systems are in place because people were like, well, we need, there's like a vacuum of we need this labor, we need the economy to function, we need employees to be going to these manufacturing plants, we need all this stuff. How do we make that happen? How do we make people want to work when they like, because I mean that's the thing, you can go out and pick a piece of land and just live on it, and what's your incentive?
You can literally live off it. That's true. Yeah.
So what's your incentive? But if you tax the piss out of people, you can only keep that land if you're working.
Yeah.
Now you have slavery, but it's not. It doesn't look like slavery. There's no whips and chains and fences and everything. It's just all mental.
Right. Yep. I get it. You know, compliance is as a small business owner, compliance with various tax codes is so whenever you make a business decision, you're always like, what's the compliance going to be? You know, what's it going to be when I get to this threshold and that threshold? How, to what extent is my relationship with my employees going to be socialized? Am I going to be, do I have any freedom to freely reward people who are just killing it as my employees? I would love to be able to, you know, say provide a pension to the top 25% of people that are just killing it and give an incentive to the other 75% to be great like this 25%, right? But you can't do that. It's a system that has to be distributed evenly. Business owners have no choice over it. And most businesses are really small. You know, we have some companies in the United States that give capitalism a bad name, but most capitalists are just people who are married to each other. That's 80%. Mom and pop companies, and we have to follow the same rules the example I was given is my son Chris, who had an Amazon store, very successful. He has to follow the exact same rules and regulations that the actual Amazon follows. There's no scale for based on your size. That's why I have my first reaction when somebody says there ought to be a law. I'm like, oh, well, trust me, there is. There's already 10 of them. You know, you haven't been to a law library lately, you know?
Right. That makes an interesting point, too, like to something you said earlier, where like when you make a law and you codify something, it's concrete.
It puts it in a box.
Yeah. When you start doing that with a business, it becomes, this is the way your business should run, instead of thinking outside of the box. It takes away the creativity.
Yeah. Your business always has to be changing and evolving or you're not in business, you know?
Yeah. So and it's, you are that correct. Confines you to like f- function the way that previous businesses have functioned that created those rules, which of course, you know, it's, and I found a lot of businesses in campaigning that are like this, like, you know, gun shops that are, that gun shops are supposed to be like totally pro Second Amendment, pro freedom, libertarian. They're run by 3%ers and ex-military who hate the military and all, you know, all these like libertarian people. And you tell them, I want to repeal some of these gun laws. I want to be able to buy a gun online and have it shipped to my house and not to an FFL. Well, we don't want to get rid of that regulation because that's going to take a cut out of my pie.
Yeah. Yeah. That's right. That's right.
So, but, yeah, you know, we have to,
everyone's got their thing they want to protect.
Yeah. You know? And most of those laws that, like, they tell you it's to keep you safe, but I guarantee you every single law that's in the book, somebody behind it was like, I could make more money if they pass this law.
Well, it's always for a good reason. Yeah. When I started the law.net, when I started that company 20 years ago, I got about 2 years in, and Patton Box, then a managing director out here, they're the biggest lobbying firm in DC. And the guy brought me downtown San Diego, looking at the yachts. And he says to me, you know, you could have one of those because we could get a law passed that requires federal agencies to buy your software. He said, how would you like that? And I was like, I wouldn't. I'm not interested. I'm only interested in doing it on the merits. I mean, that was my answer. I didn't have to think about it. I know who I am as an entrepreneur. I'm a libertarian. I do things on the merits, and I don't support systems that are, I don't support markets that are rigged. So I don't take the opportunity to participate when it's presented to me. And that definitely happened with my company. And I definitely said, no, it wasn't even, I didn't even have to think about it for 2 seconds. You know, it's when you get a deal on the merits because you created something that other people find value in, and there's nothing better than that. That's the reward. The financial part may or may not be there. The last 15 years, most of my time has been spent on things that are not financially remunerative. The LawNet is a company my wife has been running. Once we got about 3 or 4 years in, I'm the guy that comes up with the idea. I get the systems in place. Once they're in place, she's great. She's operationally great, logistically great, great with accounting, all that stuff. So you know, last 15 years, I've been out running my mouth in theaters and comedy clubs, rant and raving about civil liberties and human rights and economics and rigged games and mass incarceration and all the same things we talk about in these presidential debates. I've been talking about on the independent theater circuit and in comedy clubs and writing about it in a podcast. And it's just in my DNA to talk about these things because of the experiences that my family went through. You know, coming from the whitest state in the country, Vermont, and getting thrown into a federal prison for a while, you really get to see in 3D the disproportionate impact that these laws that prescribe substances have on people that do not share our not guilty skin pigmentation. Yeah. You know, I mean, they get hammered. And it's not meant to be that way because the 14th Amendment doesn't see colors of citizens. But the laws that are passed by the Democrats and Republicans definitely do. And and so, you know, just by having I had a couple years back, I locked myself out of my Lexus in Del Mar on a Friday night. And the cop is helping me break in. He didn't ask to see my ID or anything. I'm just a white guy in Del Mar. It all looks good. You know, it's great to be white and male in the United States.
Yeah,
it's great.
And I've seen the opposite, you know, a black guy trying to get into his own car with everything, all of the paperwork. This is my car. This is my ID.
Yeah. And he gets shot in the back.
Your computers. Yeah. In your phone.
Yeah. Yeah. Shoot him in the back while he's running away unarmed. Yeah. Man. So, you know, we have a lot of work to do. And when one of us is elected president, goddammit, it's going to get done.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, man. Well, I want to give you a couple minutes to I didn't even tell you this in the beginning. Under your beautiful picture right here, Mark Whitney, Libertarian for President, and we've got markwhitney.com. I want to give you an opportunity to plug whatever you want to plug.
Yeah, I'm just, you know, we've got the California State Libertarian Convention coming up, and I'll be the first to extend the invitation. My campaign is sponsoring, and it's all about the Love Luncheon for candidates and one guest only on noontime on February 14th, Friday, Valentine's Day. I thought we could have a nice little passive-aggressive lunch together. I thought it'd be great for Valentine's Day. And so you'll be getting that invitation, you know. And, yeah, so you can just follow the fun on markwhitney.com. My campaign is going really well. I got a great team, and I think the California State Convention is going to be a lot of fun. It's kind of like a really legitimate event, you know, because it's big and it's diverse and it's in a great venue. And you know, I just think it's going to be a lot of fun. There are 15 candidates coming. Am I the only one in California? That's kind of why I decided to do this luncheon, because I thought it would be gracious to just do something as the guy in California.
I'm actually going to. Well, is this going to be at the convention or at your place?
Yeah.
Okay.
No, it's going to be at the DoubleTree with a convention.
I'm going to be staying at the house I grew up in, which is like right up in Westchester.
Well, that's convenient.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's convenient. That's a money saver.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. What are the rooms there? Like 500 a night.
I have, my campaign has a presidential suite.
Oh,
so
nice.
we're going to be shaking people down for money and getting them drunk and stuff like that.
Awesome.
We'll get them drunk and then get their wallet. You know, that'll be and then we can go on and campaign some more. I think that's how it's meant to work.
Yeah.
We got some gangsters coming down and stuff. I don't know. We'll have a good time.
Awesome.
You know? Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
All right.
So Dan, I'm glad we had this little chat. It was
fun.
Yeah,
this was awesome.
Yeah. Thanks for inviting me on.
Yeah, absolutely. So Mark Whitney, he's definitely got my you're allowed to have him as your second choice to me, because he is a pretty awesome guy.
Yeah, and likewise for Dan Taxation and Theft. Guy goes out and changes his middle name to three words. You got to appreciate that,
right?
You know, Dan Taxation.
I still question when I write
that's
it.
Full commitment.
When I write am I supposed to put it in quotes? Because it's technically my name now, so I'm not supposed to use quotes anymore.
No, you have five names now.
Yeah, there
yeah,
we go.
Like my oldest son is Eldon Pratt Michael Whitney. He's got four names, and you have five names. Dan Taxation is Steph Berman.
There we go.
Yeah.
There we go.
Full commitment.
Awesome.
Yep.
All right, man.
All right, man.
Great having you on. Go check out the websites, we'll see you in California.
Hi, everybody. Yeah, we'll see you Valentine's Day at the It's All About the Love luncheon. You'll get your e-vite. Yeah.
Taxation is theft.
Sayonara. Yeah. Yes, it is. Yeah. Okay. Take care. Bye.
Taxation is theft.
Please, at least leave us alone in our living room.
My job is to find the truth.
Double the taxes.
I'm a human being. God damn it. My life has value.
Triple the taxes.
This is an IRS agent's dream.
If you think that the Capitol will ever treat us fairly, you are lying to yourself.
Beautiful, lovely taxes.
Sorry, but I don't do taxes.
Did you see the memo about this?
The government is a greedy piglet.
Just leave us alone.
Do you know what Ralph just said?
Roads.
You boys like Mexico?